We'll get started. I'm Chris Sharon, teaching about prophetic hip-hop, or hip-hop as a prophetic calling. And today, as the other 2 days, just for a fun introduction that encapsulates some of the really vibrant history of hip-hop, I'll show one of Jimmy Fallon and Justin Timberlake's history of rap skits that they've done on first Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, and then when Jimmy Fallon moved to The Tonight Show, they've done two of the six episodes on The Tonight Show. This is the history of rap, part five, and all the 23 songs that they name check in 5 minutes, which is pretty amazing, are listed here on the bottom. So small you probably can't read them, but that's okay. You can just listen and enjoy. And this is the end of the first week of The Tonight Show. When they first started broadcasting on Friday that first week, Justin Timberlake came on and they did History of Rap Part 5. And in previous sessions, I've highlighted a couple of things for you to pay attention to in the way they do the skit. And this time I want to just say, we're going to pause after it's over, and I'm going to draw out from you things you noticed about the performance. Could be the performance of the music that the Roots are doing live. Could be what Jimmy Fallon and Justin Timberlake do. It could be the characteristics of the songs that they're presenting in the rapid fire sequence. So just keep alert and notice things and hold what you notice in your mind, and we'll come back and have a brief conversation, in a sense, analyzing it when it's done. So here we go. Could be anything.
White audience.
Yeah.
White audience.
But right at the end, there's a black dude standing in the very back. Did you, like, right at the very end, there's this black dude standing in the back.
Security or in the audience?
I don't know.
Interesting.
How much fun you can have if you don't care what you look like.
So thinking about Jimmy and Justin and all their shenanigans. What else?
Their talent.
Yeah,
I like how you can just how different each song is, and you can hear the personality of the singer coming out. I mean, because they're such good mimics. But
when you put that many next to one another, it shows how varied the genre is.
Yeah,
exactly, both musically, but also their embodied style and the content, what the songs are about. Yeah, great. Mm-hmm. What else? Yeah,
I just, with having all those songs next to each other, I forget sometimes listening to hip hop how closely profanity and ethical statement and lyrics sit right next to each other.
Uh-huh.
More so than any other genre.
Uh-huh. Are there examples from here that brought that out for
you?
Yeah,
just, I mean, going through the songs, there's a lot more profanity, I feel, in hip hop than some other genres.
Uh-huh.
But just the frequency of, like, some ethically relevant statement. Same way between that.
Yeah. One particular place where anybody have a particular place where they were offended, thinking about the prevalence of profanity and those kinds of things, like you're saying. Anyone find themselves offended at any point?
Well, I never really liked the word bitch.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, and they intertwine two songs that center on that.
Yeah.
At that point.
Or when he stops to say mother, you know, and he pulls him back.
Yeah, when he's doing the Straight Outta Compton song.
I mean, I didn't hear it as much in this, but like usually when I'm hanging out with my friends and they're like listening to this, I'll like, I'm the only one that actually listens to the lyrics, and I'm like, are you hearing what they're saying like right now? Like it wasn't as bad as this because it's on me, but
yeah.
It can get pretty explicit.
Yeah.
And I had a problem with, not a problem, but here's these two white guys, and they're really good. They're very talented. It was seamless. And but they're, like, he's in a suit, and he's white, and it just, there's a, like, a disconnect there. I mean, it just, it's not.
The two, this is me jumping in with what I've noticed watching it over and over, which segues with this comment, is the two places where there's a consciousness of whiteness for me is when Justin stops Jimmy when he's singing Straight Outta Compton and says, "You're straight out of Compton? How do you get out of Compton?" He's like, "Well, there's many ways." And the group that, if you don't know this, the group that they're singing at that point is NWA, who were one of the first really nationally prominent groups to do what became known as gangster rap. And that song was the lead song from their first album. And it's a black genre, generally, even though there's lots of people globally who do hip-hop who aren't African-American. But its origins are very much in the black community. And that album and that group coming out of Compton and their experience is very black. So there's an interruption there, raising the question of whiteness and what Jimmy's doing, saying, "I'm straight out of Compton." The other place where that came up for me is the last song, which is Aerosmith's song, "Walk This Way." And the sound of that song is very much sort of 1970s, 1980s rock guitar. And that song was introduced to Run-DMC, who were a New York-based hip-hop group from the early 1980s, by their producer and record artist, a record label head, Rick Rubin, who was white. And he wanted, Aerosmith was kind of on the rocks, and this was their big hit from earlier in their career. And his idea was, let's take this new hip-hop group, who's kind of the new rock and roll, the new edge, and put them together and do a joint version of the song and a joint video. And Run-DMC was like, "No way are we doing that." That was their first response. "We're not doing someone else's song, someone else's lyric, especially these washed up white guys." And they eventually came around, and it was a huge hit and a crossover hit for rap artists into a much broader white audience. So that's what Rick Rubin was thinking in a calculated sort of way. This is going to be huge. So it's a very interesting moment in the racial history of hip hop and the commercial history of hip hop, and how much the commercial interest ends up connecting with the artistic decisions that are made or not made. So it's a very interesting, and they end up there with two white guys doing this white song that was done by a mashup of a hip hop group and a white group, and they go run up into this all white audience, and they're all sort of jamming to the electric guitar, played by an all black hip hop group. They're playing the music, like they're playing all the music for all these songs, and their guitarist is playing that riff. So it's, that moment is so pregnant with all the complications of what hip hop represents in our culture. So that's part of why I think these are so fascinating. Back here.
It makes me kind of wonder what Jimmy Fallon and his writers are intending. I mean, obviously it's entertaining, it's popular music, but does he also intend to be promoting or teaching? I mean, history of rap sounds like a class.
Absolutely, you know? Absolutely.
Did he speak to that at all?
I've never seen him explicitly talk about that, why they started doing this series, so I can't speak from an intelligent, like, I've researched this and I know what Jimmy Fallon thinks about it. It's interesting to note, though, that they've done it systematically over 10 years, and that by his practice, he recruited this amazing hip-hop group to be his band on his show and brought them with him to The Tonight Show. So there's a real commitment on his part to this art form, to this genre of music, and to highlighting. But on the other hand, when he was recruiting them to the late night with Jimmy Fallon, he said, "You can accompany Frank Sinatra or Tony Bennett, and you can accompany Jay-Z. There's nobody else who can do that." So he saw in them this kind of musical flexibility and virtuosity that he wanted. And it wasn't only because he loved hip-hop, but because he wanted a band that could do hip-hop and could do everything else that might show up on The Tonight Show.
Well, they played the rock really well.
Yeah. Hmm. One more comment, and then we'll move on.
I wanted to comment that I don't find this problematic,
like, yeah,
from a racial standpoint,
yeah,
because they're clearly appreciative and respectful it's not, they're not mocking and they're not, it's not a joke.
That's right. You know? It's deeply respectful.
Yeah. And I mean, which speaks to the more broad question that we sort of touched on last time of authenticity.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think that they're appropriating anything here, you know? And they are also acknowledging their whiteness and that juxtaposition. It's actually really well done.
That's right. I think that little interruption in the middle of it is a part of their authenticity, mm-hmm. and in a sense is bowing to or acknowledging the racial dynamics of hip hop and how that they're coming to it, they're honoring it, but they're also not from Compton. So I think they do it well. I think you're right. But let's jump forward and where we're going. The title for this session is President Obama Slow Jams the News. And there are, in this session, three basic stopping points, and there have been each session that I've taught, trying to thread a needle around finding your purpose in the world. And I'm trying to tell a story about finding your purpose in the world through telling the story of the Roots. I think they're an example of a group that's found a prophetic calling through their gift, which is music, and especially hip-hop. And in order to do that, I have to say a little bit about what finding your calling or your purpose in life is, and why I think that's important. And I have to tell a little bit about the story of hip-hop generally, in order to make sense of how the Roots, as a hip-hop band, are on this journey of finding and claiming their purpose as a prophetic voice with a genre they believe to be fundamentally a prophetic genre. So the first thing I want to do is just get us thinking a little bit more about this finding your calling thing and root that more explicitly than I have so far in a scriptural frame. So it comes, this particular framing I'm using comes from this great book, Creating Innovators. It's about learning to be a creative person, an artist, a creator, an entrepreneur, an inventor. And Tony Wagner basically says the developmental trajectory of finding your purpose or finding a calling moves through these three stages. Playing with all kinds of things to find out what you like and don't like, what you're good at, what you're not good at. And he says particular contexts are better or worse crucibles for that kind of play. And Questlove, who's the drummer and one of the founders of the Roots, grew up with musical parents and went on tour with them. And he recalls his dad's band, Lee Anders and the Hearts. Their drummer broke his arm when he was 12, and his dad said, "Come on, Amir, you're in." So at 12 years old, he's jumping in and playing drums with his dad's band. So he had this very intentional musical space to play in. But then through the play, you find something you love, something you're really good at, and that allows this passion and this focus to happen that can be just totally consuming, and you fixate and dig deep into that thing. But then at a certain point, hopefully you find out the place of connection where the world needs that passion that you're committed to, and you start to see a purpose, a sort of way that you connect that, and that sometimes is something we get paid for, and sometimes it's not the thing we get paid for, but it's something we're deeply committed to and that we know we love and the world needs, and that connection becomes a place where our calling becomes in service to the world. And I think one of the most profound places where this theology of calling gets worked out is in St. Paul's letters, and especially in this chapter 12 of 1 Corinthians. And there's a couple of distinctive things in this chapter that I want to highlight that frame how I'm thinking about this. The first is the beginning. You can look it up later. I was going to read the text. I don't really need to read the text. But the first part of the chapter, he says, St. Paul says, there's a variety of gifts, a whole bunch of them, in fact. What's interesting is both the variety of gifts, the spiritual gifts that people have, and that he says it this way, God activates them all.
that each of them, each of this wide variety of gifts, is a manifestation of the Spirit. And this is so important and interesting. This is in verse 7. He says, and they're a manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. So they have a directionality. The spiritual gifts are given to us. They're diverse, but they're all manifestations of the same Spirit and for the same purpose, which is our shared wellness, our shared goodness as a people, as a community, as an earth. So that's part one of it. The second part of it is his analogy about the body, which I'm sure you've heard, that we have one body but many parts. And here again, there's something really distinctive that he does with it. He doesn't just make the point that you have fingers and you have toes and you have all these different parts. But he says what I call kind of a liberation theology of the body, that there's a preferential option for the suffering part of the body, that we offer a particular kind of attentiveness to the part that's weakest or that's hurt, that needs attention. So the spiritual gifts seen as a body are drawn to, in this Christian frame he's talking about, are drawn to support those who are struggling and suffering. And one of the very interesting things to me and set me out on this journey is that Questlove and Blackbaud, the two founders of the Roots and sort of spiritual leaders of the group, have that conviction about hip-hop, that hip-hop is a way for them to have a voice for the sake of those who are suffering. And that's what makes, for them, that's what makes hip-hop a prophetic vocation. Yeah?
How have they stated that? How do you know that?
They just say that straight out.
Oh.
Absolutely. In fact, the most sort of academic, spelled out version of this is, well, one place is in, Questlove wrote a memoir called Mo Meta Blues, and he talks about it there. He has a very Christian childhood, went to a private Christian school, so his parents could keep him off the streets, keep him out of trouble. And then he went to an arts high school where he met Tariq Trotter, his partner in this endeavor. But he also talks about it in a series of articles called "How Hip Hop Failed America," How Hip Hop Failed the Black America. And the short story of that is, he says hip hop failed Black America because it became too commercialized to be a prophetic voice on behalf of those who are suffering. And he gives lots of examples for that. But he's basically engaging in an internal argument about the character and nature of hip hop. So that's a spiritual gifts frame, and I think it's worth, and I hope this doesn't just go along the trajectory of these bands, but also causes you to pause and think about your own gifts and your own passion and your own trying to find the purpose for that, the place that it fits into the needs of the world. Because that's part of what this story is about, is are all of us joining into that kind of journey. So to step back and say something about hip-hop finding its larger purpose, a way to talk about where hip-hop is now, the first session I talked about hip-hop's origins, and then last session I talked more about its kind of middle age, and where you could say where hip-hop is now is at the pinnacle of popular culture in the United States. The Roots are the band on the Tonight Show, Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. You know, they're at the, in a sense, at the pinnacle of the television platform. And then on Broadway, what's the blockbuster Broadway show? It's a hip-hop musical, Hamilton, written by a Puerto Rican New Yorker who grew up in the New York hip-hop scene and brought that to his love of musical theater. And so we're going to talk just a little bit about Lin-Manuel Miranda and in a way how he encapsulates hip-hop finding its purpose in American culture, a way to celebrate a particular genius art form that had been, in many ways, had been growing, but had never been this kind of lingua franca for the whole culture, where everyone, the presidential candidates all wanted, well, not all of them, but many of them wanted to be seen at Hamilton and got tickets to the hardest show to get a ticket to. So he grew up in Washington Heights, which is a neighborhood in Upper Manhattan on the edge of Harlem. And his first, his parents loved Broadway, and so he had these parents who loved Broadway musicals and this street group of friends who loved hip-hop, and the two worlds clashed, and he went to Wesleyan College in Connecticut and wrote his first musical, which is called The Heights. And it's about Latino immigrants in his neighborhood and the streets and the stories of his neighborhood over the course of 3 days. And rewrote and rewrote, and that went off-Broadway and then Broadway in 2008 and won the Tony for Best Musical, and all of a sudden his career was off and running. And while he, you know, kind of as a celebration for himself after he won the Tony for The Heights, he went on vacation, and he took on his vacation Ron Chernow's huge, thick biography of Alexander Hamilton, partly because he'd heard Alexander Hamilton was an immigrant from the Caribbean and kind of a scrappy dude. He was intrigued by this story as much as he knew of it. He wanted to read more about him. And he came back from vacation having read that book and said, that story is a hip-hop story if I've ever heard one. And so he started writing. And the first time he went public with this was at a special evening. It was the White House Evening of Poetry, Music, and Spoken Word in May 2009, so about a year later after his vacation. He performed the first, basically, piece of the musical, and I'm going to play that for you. And then let me just say where it goes, because I'll play that for you, and then we'll move to the roots. He worked on developing an extended set of pieces based on the life of Hamilton and worked with some friends. And they premiered off Broadway in 2015, totally sold out, rave reviews. Went to Broadway in July of 2015, and he just won every prize. He got a MacArthur Genius Award and won a Pulitzer and a Tony for Best Musical Theater, everything. So his career has just exploded. And one of the fascinating things is what he's done with that. Just two examples. One is he did something very unusual in the era of blockbuster Broadway musicals. He worked out a profit-sharing agreement so that all the people who are a part of the production share profits. Huge, huge new precedent-setting move. And he could leverage it because he literally wrote the whole thing, rather than someone, you know, writing it and selling it to a promotion agency and they get investors, that whole thing. He had some leverage because he was the person who owned the artistic rights for the show. The second thing he did with his moment, which I just think is awesome, is took some of his money and got a partnership with the Ford Foundation, or not the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Brothers Foundation, and created a structure of incentive and support for high schools across the city of New York to create, in their history classes, hip-hop renditions of the stories that they're learning in their history classes. So there's this whole sort of diffusion. He was an English teacher for a while and just thinks, you know, if this is just a really expensive Broadway musical, then I fail. So it's going some really interesting places, and he's only like, oh, here's a picture of him actually in the show. But the White House is long before the show, so he's just dressed like a normal street guy and doing it. But let's listen to Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Oh, wow. I'm thrilled the White House called me tonight because I'm actually working on a hip-hop album. It's a concept album about the life of someone I think embodies hip-hop, Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton. You laugh, but it's true. He was born a penniless orphan in St. Croix of illegitimate birth. Became George Washington's right-hand man, became Treasury Secretary, caught beef with every other founding father, and all on the strength of his writing. I think he embodies the word's ability to make a difference. So I'm going to be doing the first song from that tonight. I'm accompanied by Tony and Grammy-winning music director Alex Lacamoire. Anything you need to know, I'll be playing Vice President Aaron Burr. And snap along if you like.
Absolutely, snap along.
How does a bastard orphan son of a whore and a Scotsman dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by Providence, impoverished a squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar? The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter. By 14, they placed him in charge of the trade and charter. And every day my slaves were being slaughtered and carted away across the waves. Our Hamilton kept his guard up. Inside he was longing for something to be a part of. The brother was ready to beg, steal, borrow, water. And hurricane came and devastation rained. And a man saw his future drip, dripping down the drain. Put a pestle to his temple, connected it to his brain. And he wrote his first refrain and tested it to his pain. Collection just to send him to the mainland. Get your education, don't forget from whence you came. And the world is gonna know your name. What's your name, man? Alexander Hamilton. His name is Alexander Hamilton. And there's a million things he hasn't done. But just you wait, just you wait. Split full of it, debt ridden. 2 years later, see Alex and his mother bedridden, half dead, sitting in the room, sick, the scent thick. And Alex got better, but his mother went quick. Moved in with a cousin, the cousin committed suicide. Left him with nothing but ruined pride, something new inside a voice saying, Alex, you gotta fend for yourself. He started retreating and reading every treatise on the shelf.
Culture and the scene. Those were the four, and Afrika Bambaataa because of his deep desire to educate the youth that he was drawing out of the gangs into this hip hop culture, he added a fifth, which was knowledge. And I think that what Lin-Manuel Miranda's way of taking hip hop into the culture at large, the way that it embodies that hip hop tradition, obviously, is with the rapping, with the rhyming, but also with this really central issue in hip hop culture, which is knowledge. And it goes all the way back to this. It's been lost at times, I think, in hip hop, but there's this thread, a through thread in hip hop of wanting to teach, wanting to know where we've come from. And it's especially had an Afrocentric center, but here he's resonating with someone who has a story like the story of so many of these scrappy kids who come up out of the neighborhood and aren't going to throw away their shot. So there's a beautiful, I think, element of hip hop's history that's embodied in what Lin-Manuel Miranda's doing for good. When he went to do the Broadway cast recording, he went to Questlove and Black Thought from the Roots to be executive producers on the album. And they collaborated, and it won the Grammy for the best musical album this year, 2016. So they know each other and work together. And there's actually some wonderful skits where Lin-Manuel Miranda goes on the Tonight Show and does a freestyle rap off with Black Thought. And Lin-Manuel's fantastic. So you can, I don't have a clip for it, but you can watch it. The other key thread of hip hop culture has been political. And it goes hand in glove with cultural, with the knowledge piece. The knowledge piece, very often, because it's an expression of a oppressed minority, of a suffering people, like the blues, it has a crying out character. And that character has a political edge to it. And the Roots have used their platform increasingly to have a political voice. A voice that says something about the stakes of life in the United States for those who they call the have-nots. And I want to highlight that side of hip-hop in talking about their finding their purpose. I'd never really introduced the whole group as it exists now, and so I just wanted to put up this really lovely studio picture of them with their names all the way across so you have a sense of who they are. James plays keyboards and Kamal Gray plays keyboards, both of them. And there are also two percussionists, Frank Knuckles Walker and Questlove. And then the other ones, you can see by their instruments what they play. And when they are on the Tonight Show, they've added sax player and a trumpet player, both of whom are white, and they're just like, we can't be the Tonight Show without brass, so they added that, but they don't tour or record with them. I forget the name, they're from a really well-known band. Anybody remember the band that they got their brass from? No, but they're in their own band when they're not on the Tonight Show. So they found the beginning of their purpose, I think, in terms of the politics of hip-hop with their third album, where they did the song What They Do as this internal, pretty pointed critique of gangster rap and what they felt like was the cliches involved in that around flashy cars and almost naked women and money and champagne, sort of living the good life, getting rich and living the good life. And that sort of launched them into this place of realizing we have a platform and we have convictions and it can show up pretty directly in our music. And so their next album, which ended up being their biggest commercial hit, was called Things Fall Apart. And they have this interesting philosophy with their recordings where they try to have the album cover and the album concept itself say something personal about them as a band, something about the state of hip-hop at the moment, and something about the world. the song Things Fall Apart on the album is about a relationship breaking up. So on the personal level, there's a personal relational Things Fall Apart element going on in terms of the lyrics of the song. But then in terms of the world of hip hop, they felt like hip hop was falling apart because of the whole rise of what they saw as commercialized rap, which was formulaic. And in order to be successful, you had to talk about bitches, and you had to talk about drugs and guns and how tough you were. So they felt like this formula had happened, which took away what they loved about hip hop, which was creativity and art and music, and real substance in the lyrics, substance that talked about those sort of twin elements of knowledge and political concern about what's going on. And what was going on in the world at that time when this album came out? There's a famous encounter with President Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, which you might remember was unfolding at that time. But then there's all this stuff about harm and tension and conflict and violence going on in the world. Saddam Hussein was increasingly getting hostility from our government. Al-Qaeda was bombing US embassies around the world. Matthew Shepard was killed in Wyoming. All these, in a sense, elements of hate and division were going on. And so they reached back to this post-colonial novel, Things Fall Apart, by, someone say his name for me. And said that novel, in a sense, is about a time of tension and conflict and negotiation of cultures and power. And it just felt to them like where they were at the moment. And then the cover picture is a famous picture from civil rights riots in Brooklyn. So the whole picture of this album takes them a step forward in terms of saying, we want to say something stronger in our music about what's going on in the world, what's going on in hip hop, what's going on for us. In 2006, they switched to a different record company, to Def Jam, because they weren't commercially, after Things Fall Apart, they weren't very commercially successful with their next couple of albums, and they just were struggling with Interscope Records. Interscope didn't want to support them without big sales. And they went to Def Jam, and Jay-Z, who's a really famous hip-hop artist and had become head of the label at the time, said to them this: make an art record, do an album you'll be proud of. You're not going to get it on Hot 97, so you might as well do something that you love. So he gave them permission to not try and do a hit record, but to just go create what they most felt they ought to create. So they did this record out of the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, and their concern about what that whole episode said about the place of African Americans in our society. And a number of songs on the album and the lyrical content of the album really talk about that. But the cover really portrays what happened at Katrina with Katrina as a incident that's connected to this whole legacy of lynching of African Americans. And the cover really makes that really clear. The song that I want to highlight from this album is the last song. It's called Bread and Butter. And I put up the lyrics for the very end of the song, and then the hook or the chorus. And musically, it's the most clear connection I think I've heard of a hip-hop song to the blues. And they, in fact, on this album, explicitly tried to channel what they call not the personal blues about I lost my lover or and I'm heartbroken, but what they call blues looking outward, so what they call social lament. And they try to channel that spirit of the blues on this album, and this song really picks up. So I'm going to just play the song and let you listen to it, and you'll hear at the end of the song, then Black Thought gets to this lyric, which is very much about what was happening at Katrina and the implications for African Americans about what it means generally for them to think, are we respected, are we safe, are we, is anyone going to treat us in a way that represents our full dignity. John Legend is also, he's a soul singer, he's from Philadelphia also, and he came to them and he said, hey, let's do an album that draws on all the positivity and the social consciousness of early R&B and soul, and let's put that out there to celebrate this moment and to encourage all the good American possibility that could arise from this moment. And this song called Wake Up is the title song on the album, and it was from 1974, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. Teddy Pendergrass was the lead singer when it originally came out. And they redid it, and they invited their friend Common, who is a Chicago-based rapper, to write a verse for the break in the middle of the song. And this is what he wrote. And it really shows the way that they draw on as a group and with their set of close colleagues, a very religious sensibility in portraying hopefulness. So prophecy in the Bible and prophecy, I think, in the way they embody it in hip-hop, both has this critical side and this envisioning a hopeful future side. And this really, to me, echoes that envisioning a hopeful future or possibility. So here's that song. So it's John Lennon and Melanie Fiona is the woman who's singing with him. Super Bowl, Beyonce was performing, and at the Grammys, this really powerful performance from Kendrick Lamar. And you watch The Tonight Show, and you have this all African American house band. And this particular vignette echoes this really profoundly, because here you have the President of the United States, African American, being backed up by this house band on The Tonight Show, African American. and they're slow jamming the news in this really playful skit. And it gives the Roots, I think, a platform as they plan what they're going to do on the show, not only to be present as themselves in all these different vignettes, but then in moments like this, to send on an implicit level a powerful message just by the very fact of their presence there and the way that they join in to the skit as the people they are. So I don't want to overlook just that very fact of their endurance and their commitment to each other as a group, which allowed them, in a sense, over time, to reach this place where they could have this kind of visibility and positive impact by their presence as a creative musical. A creative musical group, but they're really creative artists in so many ways. So this is just to bring us home for our session. As you enjoy it, it's super fun and funny, but as you enjoy it, also just keep in mind that how important it is for the future of our country, where we're going with the majority minority population, to be able to have the visual images that help us to see that future that we're living into. Because it wasn't very long ago when all the images on TV and in magazines and so forth were white. So it's hard to underestimate the power of these kind of moments and what they represent for who we're becoming as a country.
Before the second term is up, naturally this is the time to look back and all that's accomplished over the past 8 years. You know, I was going to make a joke about this, but I don't think it needs the joke. I think it needs to be slow jammed. You know what I'm talking about, Tariq?
Yeah, Jimmy. I think you're saying you'd like to slow jam this news.
That's right. I want to slow jam the news, and I'm not the only one.
Constitutional right to marriage. In short, climate change is
besides, Danny's got a Hawaiian vacation booked in about 223 days. Who's got? That being said, the American people face an important decision this fall. The entire world is watching, and they look to us for stability and leadership. Now, I know some of the presidential candidates have been critical of my foreign policy. I don't want to name any names.
Some of them got Donald Trump.
Job for 8 straight years.
Jimmy, you probably never will.